Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Joseph.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. I want to apologize for being absent for the last 3 weeks. I was sick. I was in the hospital. And this really hasn't been my year. My insurance company won't pay for a whole bunch of things. And so I've really been out of it. There were complications to my kidney disorder. And it's been quite a struggle. I didn't pray as much as I wanted to during Lent. And I wasn't able really to do Easter liturgy until yesterday. This Easter Monday, that is. Today is Tuesday, April 18th. And again, I ask for your financial support, whatever you can give, to get me through this, because my insurance company is being so on top of everything else, I'm dealing with medical debt. Certain medications that are relatively new, they won't cover. Even with a prescription review. So anyway, so I apologize for being out of it. But today I want to talk about something very important. I did a show on this maybe 2010, but I want to cover it again because the theory is come under attack recently. And I'm dealing with the Khazar thesis, the origin of modern Jewry. David Duke and a few others have brought it into question, and I want to defend it. I think it's true. I think the literature on the subject is very misleading, and it's very easy to make a mistake wanting to believe that Jews are uniformly from the Middle East, and whatever extent that they ruled the Khazar Empire, it was very just a handful of elites, and that's simply not true. We'll get into that a little bit later. But the Khazar Khanate was one of the most violent, unpredictable, and wealthy of the early medieval empires. After Attila the Hun died, it filled that power vacuum. It's never mentioned in the history texts, except usually on Russia. And there's a certain fear of the Jews there. The Gentile authors would never really won't deal with it to any great extent. I think to a great extent there's a fear of the subject matter. The empire as a whole did convert to Judaism. And when I say that, I mean the teaching of the Talmud in the 9th century. The historian J.D. Burry writes the following. There can be no question that the monarch Bulan was actuated by political motives in adopting Judaism. To embrace Muhammad, Islam would have made him the spiritual dependent of the caliphs, who attempted to press their faith in the Khazars, or in Christianity lay the danger of his becoming an ecclesiastical vassal of the Roman Empire. Judaism was reputable, with sacred books, with both Christian and Mohammedan respected. It elevated him above the heathen barbarian and secured him against both against the interference of the caliph or the emperor. So it certainly made sense. Now, to talk about the forcible conversion of the population is an anachronism. To talk about all force in that regard. The population instinctively followed the religion of the rulers. This is not a private matter like it is today. Hebrew became the official script of the empire. And you see a strong shift in burial patterns at the time, marking a serious move to Jewish rights, even amongst the common population. Ahmad Ibn Falan, in his travelogue written about 922, he says, "The Khazars and their king were all Jews." Ibn Afraq, around the same time, around 930, writes, "All the Khazars are Jews, but they have been Judaized recently." The entire Kare tribe of the Turks also converted to Judaism, but they were too small to make much of a historical difference. So you have two Arabic writers making the claim that they all converted it was a multicultural empire, but here you have two very important, well-respected writers of the day saying that these were pretty much all Jews that they came across in their travels throughout the empire. The Khazar Empire straddled this incredibly strategic position between the Caspian and the Black Sea, and straddled the Islamic Empire in the Middle East, which makes part of the problem you have is the Khazar Empire actually went into the Middle East. So it's very easy to say that, well, the Jews are Middle Eastern, but they're also Khazar. The Khazar Empire really was a Caucasus Empire, but its southern border was in an Islamic world. Now, it's true the economy was a mix of a nomad pastoral life, but their staple was taxing trade on the lower Volga and Dnieper into the Black Sea. Now, I don't want to underestimate fishing or agriculture, but this taxation was a mainstay of the economy, and this is what made the Khazar Empire so powerful. They were the slave dealers of the Islamic market, raised into Slavic territories, were meant to capture slaves farther south. And even after the destruction of the empire later on, their system lived on in the Volga Bulgars, who just boarded them to the north, and the northeast, and the Turkic tribes used by Jews to continually raid into Russia. So the Khazar Empire, even in its defeat, still stayed in the area, at least in pockets, and continued the predatory raiding practices of the Khazar people. In his History of the Jews, Solomon Grazel writes, "One type of business carried on in the early Middle Ages by the Jews of Europe, namely the slave trade, requires a special word of explanation. The Jews were among the most important slave dealers. As inhabitants of Western Germany pushed their way deeper and deeper into Central Europe, driving the Slavic inhabitants farther eastward and taking away their land, they brought back captives whom they sold to Jewish traders. The Jews, in turn, transported these slaves to other lands to be sold to Christian or Mohammedan masters." End quote. Khazaria maintained, and actually minted its own coinage in the 830s, proving its economic dominance. And the Turkic tribes in the Caucasus, like the Chud, were approached both by Jews and the Russians. And when the pagan Rus invaded Byzantium, the Khazars became ally of the Greeks. Byzantine Empire and the Khazars became allies against the newly developing empire of Rus, Kiev. Dr. Stephen Jones, a scholar within the Christian Identity School, has shed a great light on the identity of Gog and Magog, one of the most important elements here. The Khazar Empire was identified in the Middle Ages almost exclusively with these apocalyptic tribes. The British Church insisted that this was Russia only during the Crimean War, but before that, it was always the Khazar Empire. In addition, the anonymous Gog, Magog, and the Kingdom of the Khazars, which came out in 2001, as well as my late friend Harold Rome's work, is also central to research in this field. There's a tremendous amount of scholarship that unfortunately hasn't gotten the attention that it's deserved. Rabbi Pekia of Regensburg, in his Travelogue in the 12th century, he states that the kingdom of Khazaria was that of Mesek. The Talmud itself makes reference to the Ashkenaz, a town near the Black Sea, in a village now in Turkey. It was used more broadly to refer to the Khazar Empire in general. The Talmud also argues that the Ashkenaz were descended not from Shem, but rather from Japheth, even through Gomer. And it would make their uncles, Magog and Tubal. Benjamin of Tudela, another traveler who met with the Khazar nobility negotiating trade deals from Iraq, and he emphasized tremendously that Khazaria was an entirely Jewish state, not just the elite. Ibn Fadlan, a well-known Arab merchant and traveler in the 8th century, stated that the Khazars and their king are all Jews. Now you have four major travelers at the time. He continues and he says, "The Bulgars and their neighbors are subject to him, namely the Khazar Empire. They treat him with worshipful obedience. And some are the opinion that Gog and Magog are the Khazars," end quote. One of the most important, though, in the Christian world is the Orthodox Church in Aquitaine. Aquitaine, as I've said before, is one of the most, if the most important part of early medieval Western Europe. It was very Romanized, very Greekified. It was by far the wealthiest part of Western Europe. And it sat on the Mediterranean, and maintain the traditions of the Roman and Grecian Empire long after the Germans had taken everywhere else. To take Aquitaine was to dominate all France at the time. That church was very powerful, Greek-speaking, and they equated Khazaria with Gog and Magog without question, because their own far-flung commercial empires, enterprises, I should say, led to regular contact with them in the eastern Mediterranean. Aquitaine was a Greek enclave, and the cardinal work concerning this view was Druthmar's exposition of the evangelical work of St. Matthew. And he says the following. One of the Jews undertook the conversion of the Khazars, who were composed of many peoples, and they were converted and joined to his religion. This happened during the days of the Abbasids. This was a man that came single-handedly to a king of great rank, very spirited people, and were converted without any recourse to violence or the sword, and took upon themselves difficult obligations enjoined by the law of the Torah, like circumcision, ritual ablutions, washing of discharge of the semen, prohibition of work on the Sabbath during feasts, the prohibition of eating of flesh, forbidden animals, according to the religion, and so on. End quote. The economic benefits of this conversion are plain, since usury for the Jews is forbidden, but against Gentiles it's encouraged. It became a predatory society by definition. Yehuda Halevi says, the king and his vizier traveled to the deserted mountains on the seashore, and they arrived one night in a cave where some Jews were celebrating the Sabbath. They disclosed their identity to them, embraced their religion, were circumcised in his cave, and then returned to their country, eager to learn the Jewish law. They kept their conversion secret, however, until they found an opportunity of disclosing the fact gradually to a few of their special friends. When the number had increased, they made their affair public and induced the rest of the Khazars to embrace the Jewish faith. They sent to various countries for scholars and books and studied the Torah. The chronicles also tell of their prosperity and how they beat their foes, conquered lands, secured great treasures, how the army swelled to hundreds of thousands, how they loved the faith, fostered its love for the Holy House, and erected a tabernacle in the shape built by Moses, and also honored and cherished the Israelites who lived among them. So there were actually Middle Easterns there. But now we have six major writers of the time saying that this empire is purely Jewish. That's not to say that there were others outside of it, but this was a Jewish society, and local elites, the common people, and certain federal elites, we would call, also had converted. All this really means that the people of Khazaria and Mas gradually became Jewish. Now, this was a very large population. And second, that the explosion of the Jewish population in Europe after the destruction of the empire under Svatoslav I of Kiev can only be understood by the breaking up of an empire this powerful. So around the turn of the first millennium, you have this flood of Jews into Central Europe. And it can only be explained, and this exploding of the population in Central and Eastern Europe can only be explained by the breakup of a powerful empire like that. So by the 880s, Khazar control over the Dnieper from Kiev, they collected tribute from the Slavs, began to weaken. Oleg of Novgorod took control from Asgold and Dir and laid the foundations for the modern idea of what you have Kiev and Rus today. Southern raiding of the Rus was permitted by the Khazars only if they turned over 50% of their take with their Jewish betters. In other words, Turkish tribes were encouraged to attack the Kievans so long as half the booty was turned over to the Khazar. It served their interests because it permitted the Muslim Arabs and the Rus to fight each other, leaving the Khazars as well-off middlemen now safe from attack. Well, this is a very common tactic. But as Kiev continues to grow, a war was inevitable, and its leadership attacked the Khanate more than once. Oleg was defeated in 941, but soon after, the Khazars finally shut down the passage through the Volga to the sea. And the reason for this is that the Byzantines and the Rus were finding common ground against the Khazars. The old tradition of Byzantine-Khazar cooperation had faded, and all-out war was coming. And even the local tribes, like the Pechenegs, were slowly being brought into the Byzantine orbit. It might have been that the system of extortion was finally catching up with these predators in Khazaria. So Oleg's successor, Svatoslav I, who died in 972, took the capital Itil in 968. And the city was razed to the ground, and that was the end of the empire. Now the Quran, even talking about the Gog and Magog are these tribes that will attempt to destroy the church in the last days. They were always associated up until the 19th century with the Khazar. The Quran says the people of Gog and Magog were belligerent and ruthless, attacking all countries and destroying all life. The Georgian and Armenian chronicles at the time universally see the Khazars of Gog as Gog and Magog. The quote is, "Wild men with horrible faces and manners of wild beasts feeding on blood." That's how they were described in both Georgian and Armenian chronicle. Heinrich von Neustadt, in around 1300, which Arthur Kessler refers to, and B.N. Zachode writes in their Caspian collection on Eastern Europe that the early medieval church universally considered the Khazars Gog and Magog. Now, the identity of Gog and Magog are the utmost importance for Christians in these times. In fact, in the final days, these are the nations that Satan will gather together to battle and are scattered all over to the four corners of the earth. In the Old Testament, these people are mentioned by in Ezekiel 38. Gog is the ancient Semitic word for the mountain of darkness. It refers to a people, militant force, rather than a person, really. Prince is not necessarily a person, but also the ideology of a group, a leader, or the molder of a group of people, and hence its prince, so to speak. Magog also refers to a mountain, or the militant camp, so to speak, the violent camp. And the term Magog, which is taken both from Mog and Magog, was a pejorative term at the time, referring to the worship of the demon Ashtoreth, the worshippers of the moon, another term for them. So Ezekiel in 38:10, he says the following. He says, "This is what the Sovereign Lord says. On that day, thoughts will come into your mind. You'll devise an evil scheme. You'll say, 'I'll invade a land of unwalled villages. I'll attack a peaceful, unsuspecting people, all of them living without walls and without gates and bars. I will plunder and loot and turn my hand against the resettled ruins and the people gathered from the nations, rich in livestock and goods, living at the center of the land.'" End quote. The Jewish elites then had a strategy, so to speak, of looting a trusted people. In the U.S., the Jews have prospered like no other time in their history. And Americans refuse to believe the predatory nature of this prosperity that Talmud emphasizes. The puerile belief that Jews are connected to the Israelites of the Old Testament leads Protestants to argue that only the Russians are Gog and Magog and will invade Israel. Now Ezekiel refers to Gog as Prince of Rosh, which is anachronistically connected to Rus. The Khazar theory suggests that there is no connection between Israelites and Jews, and even if there were, the religion of modern Jews bears no relationship whatsoever to the Israelite faith, is vehemently condemned in the Talmud. Israel is the Orthodox world. The New Israel was a common nickname for the Byzantine Empire, don't forget. But David Duke and a few others have attacked the Kessler thesis. I learned a lot from David Duke over the years. He's not an academic, but his research into this area has been substantial. His work shouldn't be ignored in this respect. I think it does need to be answered, however. His claim seems to be that since the intellectual leaders of the Khazar thesis were secular, often Marxist Jews, their work should be ignored. David says the following here. "One thing I did not know then was that Kessler, a communist Jew who popularized the Khazar theory, bragged in a Jewish magazine that he advanced the theory as a way to fight anti-Semitism. His theory was that since the Gospels and the Europeans blamed Jews for the crucifixion of Christ, he could make the Europeans believe that they are not related by blood to the Christ killer Jews, talked about in the New Testament, that he could lessen hatred against them." End quote. First of all, that's a non sequitur. In adopting the ethic of the Talmud, they adopt the mentality of the Pharisees, whose arrogance served as the early foundation of the Talmud. Now, Christ killer was never really an issue. Jews were kicked out of every nation, nation after nation, group after group, city after city, due to a remarkably similar set of accusations: usury, fraud, and to some extent prostitution. The Christ killer thing didn't come up very often. You know, they weren't kicked out because they killed Christ. They were kicked out of these cities because of these very specific criminal charges laid against them. Now, he does cite a number of genetic articles. Articles dealing with DNA that really neither of us have the expertise to truly digest. The problem is that there are just as many that argue the opposite. A few include the Bray study of 2010, which argues that the DNA evidence places the Ashkenazi Jews squarely in southeastern Europe. Almut Nebel, who writes in his study, quote, "In comparison with the data available from other relevant populations in the region, Jews were found to be more closely related to groups in the north of the Fertile Crescent, Kurds, Turks, and Armenians, than to their Arab neighbors," end quote. Just this year, Kolosov and Falivna wrote an article called "Excavated DNA from Two Khazar Burials." It came out in Advances in Anthropology 2017. And they mentioned the genetic marker R1AZ93, very common in present-day Turkic-speaking people, such as the Caucasian Balkars, the Tartars, Bashkirs, Kyrgyz, and other populations who apparently descended from the Scythians, and have their common ancestors dating back 2,500 years ago. This real issue was the definition of a Khazar. Their identity after the adoption of the Talmud was religious, not ethnic. They used mercenary soldiers. They were an ethnic mix of people. Judaism was a way. It had economic benefits, it had political benefits, but it also unified this wildly multicultural group of people. Now, political agendas, regardless of on either side, shouldn't color this debate. But they've been Russian language articles defending the Kessler thesis from Simonov, Sobolev, Kudratsev, are only in Russian. And there are many others that can be mentioned. Now, here's a problem. How can this be? You have totally opposing conclusions on the same question using essentially the same methods. Now, political considerations play a role, but not a comprehensive one. There is one study, the Behar study, that says the following. I'm going to quote this at some length. "It has been claimed, however, that through a reanalysis of some of our data, a large part of the ancestry of the Ashkenazi population originates with the Khazars, a Turkic-speaking group that lived in the north of the Caucasus region roughly 1,000 years ago. Because the Khazar population has no obvious modern descendants that could enable a clear test for a contribution to Ashkenazi Jewish ancestry, the Khazar hypothesis has been difficult to examine using genetics. Furthermore, because only limited genetic data have been available in the Caucasus region, and because these data have always been concentrated in populations that are genetically close to the population of the Middle East, the attribution of any signal of Ashkenazi Caucasian genetic similarity to Khazar ancestry or shared ancestral Middle Eastern has been problematic." In other words, they're both the same thing. They're measuring the same group of people. And that's from the abstract of the Behar study. In other words, what the opponents of the Khazar theory have not considered is that minimal genetic data has been taken from those presently living in the Caucasus. Studies of Ilik, someone that David Duke attacks quite to a great extent, are one of the few who bothered to compare the genetics of the Ashkenazim to Georgian and the Armenian. And when these populations are used as comparison, 70% show a match, which demonstrates very strongly that the Khazars were from this area, or overwhelmingly Jewish, as we said before, and are not of Middle Eastern origin. Another important statement that they make, they say that only limited genetic data have been available from the Caucasus region, and because these data have been concentrated in populations that are generally close to the population of the Middle East, as I've said before, the conclusions are mentioned in the premise. They define Near East as actually including the Caucasus Mountains and the Black Sea region. Therefore, most Jews will match this new definition of Middle Eastern. Because the Khazar Empire goes into the Middle East, it's very easy to confuse. Now, when genetic material is matched to southeastern Hungarian, Georgian, or Armenian, Khazar theory is vindicated. In other words, what I'm trying to say here is that the Behar study mentions that saying that DNA matches Middle Eastern populations doesn't say anything, because they're defining the Middle East as moving up into the Black Sea and Caspian region, which is, of course, the southern part of the Caucasian Mountains. So it doesn't prove anything. The only way to really do this is to take samples from those clearly not Middle Eastern, like Armenians, and connect them there. And there you do have a tremendous connection, not a total connection. The theory goes like the geographic population structure, which converts DNA into its ancestral location. has pinpointed the origin of Yiddish speakers. Now, Yiddish is not Hebrew. Yiddish is largely a Turkic language. And the English language comes from four villages in Turkey. This would be expected if the Khazars, which were a Turkic people, were their original foundation. The four villages are Ishkenaz, Ashkenaz, Ashkenaz, and Ashkuz. The connection to the term Ashkenazi is unmistakable here. Their findings imply that Yiddish was created by Slavo-Iranian Jewish merchants plying a silk road between Germany, North Africa, and China. The ancient villages are close. Those villages that I mentioned are close to the convergence of the Silk Road. The authors mentioned that the Northeast Turkey is the only place in the world where these names exist. Closely implies that the Yiddish was established for the first millennium of the time, around the first millennium, I should say, where Jewish traders who were at the Silk Road moved goods from Asia to Europe and wanted to keep their monopoly on trade. The point was to maintain their economic power. And the Jewish Forward recently has denounced the Khazar, this thesis, because again it shows Jewish population as always being this economic predatory people who have always used their nationalism to keep others out and to maintain all benefits and profits inward. And this is proof positive that Yiddish is not a Germanic language, although there are certain elements from all over the place. But you have four villages in Turkey that sound a lot like Ashkenaz, and that the use of the Yiddish language, which of course is not Hebrew, the script that they used in Khazaria was Hebrew, but not the language. And it's funny, the Yiddish contains 251 words for terms buy and sell. So the book seems to be closed on this from a linguistic standpoint. And this is absolutely essential to justifying the thesis here. So what have I done? I've demonstrated to a great extent, number one, that the most substantial travelogues of the time of the height of the Byzantine, of the height of the Khazar Empire, said that the entire population, for the most part, were Jewish. In other words, followers of the Talmud. Number two, that the Jews were associated with Antichrist, that is to say, the armies of Gog and Magog that were going to make war on the church in the last days, which backs up my thesis that the Jews are, in fact, Antichrists collectively. And that was the tradition of the ancient church all throughout Europe, but certainly in Aquitaine and elsewhere. And even the Quran says the same thing. Number three, that Yiddish comes from Turkey, not from Germany. Turkey is, you know, sort of a part of the Middle East, I guess you could say, but not entirely. And number four, the reason we have these genetic problems, why you can have totally opposite conclusions from the same set of data and the same methods, all comes from the fact that people are defining Middle East whatever they want. The concept of Middle Eastern, they often include Turkish, they often include Caucasian Mountains, the area between the Caspian and Black Sea, which of course then means that the Jews of Middle Eastern says nothing, because they're saying that Khazaria, at least the southern part of Khazaria, is in fact Middle Eastern anyway. So it's completely, it doesn't prove anything. The only way to do this properly is to connect the not only the genetic material, but also the linguistic material to people already living there. Georgians, Armenians, Southeastern Hungarians, and some Turks. And when you do that, it's pretty clear that Yiddish is a Turkic language and not a German one. And these are of extreme importance in understanding this thesis. So not only is Khazaria of immense importance to Russian studies, the smashing of the Khazar Empire under Svatoslav I was essential to the growth of Russia, because the Khazars made their money by charging tolls on all trade going into the Black Sea and Caspian Sea, which was predatory. In other words, they're not producing anything. This is the bulk of their income. And also that, when a society is growing like that of the Kievan Rus, they're not going to tolerate this kind of interference in their growth anymore. And so it's going to come down to a showdown. And once that was clear, the Byzantines sided with the Kievan Rus. There was a bishop in Khazaria from Byzantium. There were some Christians there, usually traders from abroad. But the nature of the Khazar Empire was such that their violence, their extreme methods, their total, you know, there's no chivalry there. There was no rules of war there. These are mercenary forces. The Yiddish-speaking elites didn't trust native soldiers. And since there really was no ethnic connection among these people, it was linguistic only, and artificially linguistic and religious, that they used, kind of like the Italian city-states, used mercenaries. So they couldn't gang up against the leadership. They had no real particular reason to follow the rules of war. They weren't connected with the Khazar states. They could do what they pleased. And because of the extreme violence, far more than any other empire at the time, that they were known as the Antichrist. And this was one of the things that the Aquitanian church was saying, that the reputation for extreme levels of violence are matched only by Assyria, the Syrian Empire in the Old Testament. Slaughtering POWs, slaughtering civilians was a normal thing for them. And this is how they became the most fearsome and feared group of warriors in the Middle East. So I think that's been demonstrated to a great extent. It's not to say that there aren't some Jews that are from the Middle East in the normal sense of the term. But the Talmud alone shows that there is clearly a separation between Israelites and modern Jewry. The Talmud alone is your point of break. Even the prophets were condemned in the Talmud. The Talmud has nothing to do with the Old Testament. Therefore, Judaism has nothing to do with the Old Testament. So I think that's pretty much it as far as that's concerned. There's one other thing I wanted to mention. There is, and again, the Khazar Empire is so important. The main thing that, you know, the reason that there's been an attack in the last 30 years on the Khazar thesis is that it's so associated with anti-Semites. People who don't like, or at least anti-Zionists, I should say. And that if you can show that modern-day Jewry overwhelmingly doesn't come from the Middle East or, you know, present-day Israel, they have no right to be there. So it's not merely because, you know, these are communist Jews and they're trying to use it for that agenda. It's also because they want to make this claim that Zionism is legitimate. Because if Jews are from that part of the world, then maybe they do have a better claim than they do right now. Zionism has always been vehemently opposed to the Khazar theory for that reason. I also want to mention that New Khazaria is being built on the Dnieper right now. There's M. Kirill, the web journal, the Institute of Russian Communitarianism, makes a claim that there actually is a new Khazar empire being built on the Dnieper. In Ukraine, that when the violent coup that took over in 2014, the revolution there defended itself precisely on the model of the IDF. Gennady Korban, Igor Komolsky, and the Jewish head of the right sector, Dmitry Karosh, took control of the military operations against Donbass and for the riots themselves. Huge amounts of military operation against the Donbass have been spent already. Now, as far as Khazaria itself, he states in the final penetration of rabbinic Judaism into the dividing ruling elite, didn't occur to the beginning of the 9th century. Obadiah, which is Bulan's son, forced Talmudism on the elite. But then all local schools, I should mention this before, this is a case going on today, all local schools were teaching basic Jewish belief. This is another piece of evidence under Obadiah that the population as a whole were Jewish. All local schools were teaching Yiddish and basic Jewish thought. So there was a dual government created where the Kagan was overshadowed by the Bulan clan, that is, the Jews. It had already penetrated the elite by 740 once the Muslims were driven out. The failed Jewish revolution in Iran sent a small army of Jews to Khazaria, which is how they got there in the first place. And they were granted welcome by Bulan and his clan. And this mass exodus from Iran kind of plugged into the Jewish trading elites at the time serving as bodyguards. Judaism emerged triumphant there due to the toll extracted not only in the Dnieper and Lower Volga trade, but as I mentioned before, the caravan route to the Great Silk Road. And today in Ukraine, the top 15 most affluent oligarchs, as you know, in the country are Jews. So it's the exact same concept today as back then. Kirill reports that they have formed an association calling themselves Khazarian, and the new leader is called the Kagan. The Jews have a semi-secret government in control in Ukraine that calls themselves New Khazarian. It includes the head of the Zionist Committee of Ukraine, Yosef Zessels, Leonard Feinberg, financed by the U.S., and the director of Jewish studies at the Kiev Mohyla Academy, which is, by the way, bizarre that there's even Jewish studies there at all. But the heads of the street thugs that took over in 2014 were Shimon Birman and Otto Mogilsky. The Kiev Rabbi Moshe Frontman, Ilya Klitschko, and Yesenia Pak, not to mention their whole run of oligarchs in the country, such as Pinchuk, Shurkus, and Ulatsky, these are exclusively Jewish. So the riots in 2014, the secret cult in Ukraine calling themselves New Khazarian, generally shows that the overwhelming majority of the Jews today see Khazaria as a Jewish homeland. And that is really the place, as Jews are being overrun just from demographics there, that it's time to move out. And that Ukraine may become, especially if there's any drive to kick the Jews out of America, which is almost inconceivable, but that the new Khazar Empire is in fact true Zionism. And it's been made clear, and only if you read Russian can you get into this at all, that new Khazaria is actually being built on the southern Dnieper. So this is like the secret mercantile clans ruled alongside the Kegon and Khazaria. These oligarchs, the same source of wealth, rule from the sidelines. It's the exact same thing as in the 800s. It's amazing how the Khanate is being restored to its former glory with the same ruthlessness as before. Now, that's kind of an eccentric way to prove my thesis here, but it needs to be taken very seriously. I mentioned the way that the Khazars integrated themselves into Khazar society after the failed revolution in Iran. There was a Jewish attempt to take over the government there, and it failed. And this is how they ended up in Khazaria. Because they found it so congenial that already these native tribes, which by the way included Jews already, just not in any dominant way, was congenial that they were involved in this trade and they took over and they created a secret government. Roughly by, the Muslims were driven out by 880, or even earlier than that. And it became a dual system. The older Kagan, which was only partly Jewish, ruled alongside a more secretive group of rabbis around the Bulan clan and its predecessors. You have the same situation now where you have the secret group, very secretive group of oligarchs calling themselves New Khazaria, are at war with the Gentiles who are more or less fictitious rulers, like Poroshenko and others, and the Rada. And even the rioters, which were overwhelmingly non-Jewish, so the leadership was Jewish. It's the exact same process as you saw after the Iranian Revolution in the 9th century. You had a dual government in Khazaria, at least early on. You have a dual government in Ukraine. And increasingly, this dual government is becoming more and more obvious. And the Jewish elites and traders and oligarchs were far more powerful than the civilian government. And that was the same Khazaria as it is in Ukraine today. There's no doubt that there is a very powerful movement of Jewish oligarchs in Ukraine and Russia that believes that the resurrection of Khazaria is the way to solve the problems in Israel. Israel is disappearing. The average Arab family has something like between 6 and 8 kids. The average Jewish kid family only has about 2. So they're going to lose this war. What are they going to do? Well, they can immigrate to New York City. The U.S. is considered the promised land. But then there's another move, a parallel move, to create another Jewish homeland, a more congenial one, in that part of the Ukraine, almost the same place, just a bit to the north, the same place the old Khazar Empire used to be. And they're doing the same kind of things. They're not producing anything. They're charging rents as their own Khazar forebearers did in the past. So the process is exactly the same, suggesting that there's a great folk memory here of how Jews came to take over the initial Khazar Empire, which had many had Christians there, pagans there, Muslims, Jews, and was able through money to take over. And from there, they built the school system under Obadiah, who was Bulan's successor. And that brought the population as a whole into Judaism. They didn't, there is a unity there, but it was an artificially enforced unity. And there is some reason to believe that there was no real violence, only the school system and the realization that Judaism was a great economic investment that made sense for an empire of that type. But Khazaria was a bizarre place, only because of the violence of the soldiers, but also the fact that overwhelmingly it was predatory. It did nothing but charge rents. Its agriculture was minimal, but it was powerful enough through these rents where it could, and of course, you know, hiring Turkish tribes to attack Russia, to attack Hungarians, and bringing back 50% of the booty to themselves. And then they had the diplomatic support of the empire. So it was a tremendous arrangement. So much of what happened, the slave driving raids, even after Khazaria was destroyed, come from the fact that these Turkish tribes were being built up. And the Volga-Bulgars are another example of this, were being built up to the point where they had tremendous confidence in their ability to attack and defeat Russians, or at least push far enough in to get take slaves. Hundreds of thousands of slaves were taken during and after the Khazar Empire to the main center was Ankafa in the Black Sea, an island of the Black Sea. And these were sold mostly to Islamic the caliphs and elites in that part of the world. But there's been some question about me connecting Gog and Magog to the Jews and therefore Antichrist to the Jews. I want to reiterate again that only when the Crimean War broke out in the 1840s did Antichrist become attached to the Russians, because Russia was becoming already a major threat to the British Empire. And to take Western Christianity and put them against the Russians, could the coalition that fought the Russians in the Crimean War be held together, at least from an ideological standpoint. Prior to that, there was no question that Khazar Jews were Gog and Magog, and therefore the ferocious warriors. Now, the connection is that even in the Old Testament, Gog and Magog were said that they were going to be extremely violent people, more so than your average army. You see it in the Old Testament. You see it, as I mentioned before, in both Georgian and Armenian Chronicles, that the Khazars were extremely violent. You see it in Aquitaine, that these were a feared, ferocious group of people. They didn't live according to the moral norms of any other society, including Islamic society. Because Judaism is so insular and treats local Jews very well, but foreigners very badly, that this was permitted to happen. Plus the fact it was a mercantile state. They had really no law that wasn't just about making money. And also that they used mercenary forces that didn't care. They didn't really care what the reputation of the Khazars were. They were from all over the place. But remember, even after the fall of the Khazar Empire, really all that happened were the major cities were burnt to the ground. And a huge amount of that population moved to Central Europe. And, you know, around the turn of the first millennium, you have this big explosion of Jews pouring into that area. It only makes sense if these Jews are from Khazaria, and hence not from the Middle East. It's not to say that they're the initial group of Jews, even from Iran, were not Middle Eastern or from Israel, but that they mixed early on with the convert. Maybe these were missionaries at the time. You don't really see that much today, but they were missionaries. They wanted to convert people. More than one Turkish tribe had converted to Judaism at the time. And of course, a tribal society, the tribe converts, not just the leadership. That's totally anachronistic. You can't have a medieval society where the elites were one thing and the common population something else. In tribal societies, that's simply how the tribe functions as a unit. There's no privacy there. You don't make private decisions in things like religion. Religions were the ideological glue that held the people together. There's no doubt about this. I also want to stress again the slogan from Ezekiel 38. He speaks of a group of people, Gog and Magog, that will attack an unarmed group of people. They'll attack cities without walls, without defenses. I think there's good reason to believe that refers to the insidious nature of modern Jewry and how they present themselves as a harmless group of people, but in fact of evil design. That's what Ezekiel means. There weren't a whole lot of pretty innocent, unwalled cities at the time. So he's referring to something else. He's referring to a symbol. People who don't know what they're getting into by bringing the Jews in. As I mentioned before, Izyaslav in Kievan Rus had brought the Jews in as traitors. You saw this, and these were Khazars, of course. The Polish elites brought Jews in as traitors to dominate the inner city so as to take that power away from the monarch. They didn't realize what they were getting into because, of course, when they first approach these Gentile societies, they don't disclose what their designs really are. They flatter them. They say how this is going to be mutually beneficial. You're going to be rich beyond your wildest dreams. And whatever the agenda was, the Jews said they were going to promote it. Only later on, when they grew in power, did they turn on their hosts in the first place. And that's what Ezekiel means when he's referring to they're going to attack unwalled cities, innocent people who don't know any better. There's also a suggestion, of course, that these people don't care. They'll slaughter unarmed people, no problem. And they did. It does suggest, too, even further than that, that the Khazar elites were in a precarious situation. The Italian city-states during the Renaissance almost all had mercenary armies, and partially because they had money but a small population, but also because the oligarchs who ruled the society didn't want to ever be challenged by their military protectors. This was the case in Novgorod as well. Even in Albania today, I've mentioned this before, the military has been cut down almost nothing. Because when oligarchs rule something, they don't want a strong military. Because in an oligarchical system, the military is patriotic, nationalist, and completely opposed, therefore, to that Khazar Jew mentality. If there's ever a coup, the Jews are finished. So wherever they go, not the Albanians aren't Jewish, but it is an oligarchical society. Same thing for the Italian city-states. They wanted the army to be kept very small or to be formed from mercenary forces that are brought in, mobilized, and then demobilized as soon as the campaign was over. In this way, any kind of patriotic military force will never get in the way of their control. This is extremely important to understand, and it suggests that this was a purely oligarchic society, no different than the society in modern-day Ukraine. And not until I began researching this did I realize that there was this secret dual government in Ukraine where oligarchs actually ruled everything and used the civilian government as cover. Again, this is why Putin in Moscow and Lukashenko in Belarus are so immensely important, because they overthrew that duality. The secret government doesn't exist anymore in those two countries. And they can only do this by this very intensely centralized control of the state. Democratic systems, which are promoted by the Khazars today, democratic systems are weak. Democratic systems are unable, really, and they're decentralized systems, unable to make war on oligarchs. A constitutional system like you have in the U.S. is incapable of making war on oligarchy, incapable of making war on major drug clans, the problem you have in America today. Only centralization and a very strong state can fight the interests of those clans. This is why Putin is reviled, Lukashenko is reviled beyond belief. And a government so-called in Ukraine, which is not really a government at all, is the exact opposite. The secret government of the oligarchs, New Khazarian, is far more powerful than the government in Kiev. Not merely because there's a shadow government somewhere, but also that the Americans control Kiev. Kiev today has no functional economy at all. Every productive piece of capital is owned by foreigners. Their currency exists only due to foreign aid. It's the only thing propping it up. It's absolutely worthless, economically speaking. And so the exact opposite has occurred. So the Americans and the foreign donors run everything. And so now the central government in Kiev has absolutely no power from two different points of view. The shadow government in New Khazarian on one hand, and the U.S. on the other. So in the true sense of the word, the government in Kiev are puppets. The same thing occurs in Khazaria as well. And this is why this oligarchical system is now referring to itself as New Khazaria, and the head of it, which is a rotating head, is called Kagan. Very common Jewish name is Kaganovich, the son of the Kagan, which is strictly a Khazar, a concept. And there isn't much connection between the Khazar system of government and Kievan Rus, primarily because of the use of mercenary forces. The oligarchs wanted to take power. Right now in Kiev, the army, Ukrainian army, has largely fell apart, has fallen apart, and thousands have deserted. There's no money anyway, so any sustained campaign against Donbass or anywhere can't be done. So overwhelmingly, the Novorossiya, their POWs that they're capturing are come from all over the world, mostly from the Baltics, from Turkey, Poland, Georgia. Most of those arrested in the riots in 2014 come from Georgia. So even there, you have the use of mercenary forces. That's how similar the two systems are here. There's no question. Following conclusions can be brought forth here. There's no doubt in my mind. Number one, talking about the Middle East, we have to be very careful as to how we define it. Too many of these studies creates this very broad concept of the Middle East that actually goes into the Khazar Empire. So they're actually measuring the same thing. It's so overlapped that it doesn't really mean much. Secondly, the Jews themselves overwhelmingly, especially in Ukraine, that part of the world, see Khazaria as the homeland, not Israel. Israel's too small, and demographics are against it. I believe that there are two homelands fighting for significance. The first is New York City and the American general, and the second is Khazaria in Ukraine, New Khazaria. Although over the last few years, the rise of nationalism in America may be frightening some Jews. And the same thing may be going on in Ukraine at the time. But since the Jewish elites have taken over these nationalist organizations, I want to make another point here, by the way, that traditional Ukrainian nationalism is perfectly legitimate. There's nothing wrong with it. Their ideology is no different. They're national socialists. They never trusted the West. They're not capitalists or anything else. These are not the groups that were involved in the riots in 2014. These were Judaic organizations adopting right-wing terminology, at least the leadership level. These were not Ukrainian nationalists. On what grounds could a Ukrainian nationalist possibly desire the Western system of oligarchical government being imposed in Ukraine, supporting the EU? What nationalist group could support the EU? It's ridiculous. Of course, these aren't nationalists. My biggest problem in politics right now is that legitimate Ukrainian nationalists, including that of Bandera, have been so poisoned by the events of 2014 that it's lost all of its legitimacy. There is a very strongly legitimate philosophical concept of Ukrainian nationalism, It's not anti-Russian so much as it's anti-Soviet and anti-St. Petersburg, at war with Peter the Great and his successors, which is also quite legitimate. Remember, even the pro-Russian Cossacks did not trust Moscow. And many of them went into exile as well when the Muscovites had enough of them. But number two, that the genetic studies are highly problematic for that reason. But number three, that the Jews see themselves as new Khazari in that part of the world. Number four, the school system created an entirely Judaic society. And number five, as I've said before, only when you bring in genetic testing with local populations there do you get a huge amount of overlap, proving that Jews are, in fact, Khazars. And finally, that there has to be an explanation. This explosion of Jews coming into Central and Eastern Europe, starting around the year 1000, to the point where they became huge in Ukraine, Poland especially. 90% of the world's Jews were in the Polish Empire by 1600. There's millions of people. That wouldn't make any sense if they're just a small tribe from the Middle East. From Israel, that is to say. I think I've proven all of that quite substantially. And here's one of these medieval topics that is very, very real today. Jews have one very positive aspect of themselves that Gentiles don't have, and that is an extremely well-developed sense of history and dates and anniversary. Unfortunately, New Khazaria is being built on the backs of Ukrainian workers. This is going on right now. Only thank God for Putin and Lukashenko, who shoved the shadow government out of power. And this is the sole reason why they've come under attack from the West. Ukraine right now is a basket case. It's not a real country anymore. It has a puppet government being dominated from at least two sides. And a country that has such tremendous potential being destroyed by these by the Americans on the one hand and the Jews on the other hand is so outrageous that it gets my blood boiling. So I want to say, congratulate everybody on Holy Pascha. Christ has indeed risen. And again, I ask your assistance, as I always do. And there will come a time I won't need it anymore, and I hope the time comes very soon. Those who have already been helping me, I thank you very, very much. It's always been very difficult for me to ask for money, even talk about money. That's not my history. I've never done it before until very recently. And when I was doing well years ago, I gave money to a lot of different people in our movement who were struggling. I'm proud to say. When I had it, everyone could have it. And I'll get to that way, get to that place again. So I appreciate your indulgence. Thank you very much. And I will talk to you next time. Goodbye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.